Her new book, a collection of some of her essays, is entitled Chick's a Goddess, or How I Spent My 40s. Wendy Wasserstein, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you here. First of all, for our listeners, and I guess there are some of them that may not know, explain what a Chick's a Goddess is.
Chick's a Goddess. Well, it's not me. I think when a Jewish boy marries sort of a perfect non-Jewish girl, that the mother would call her a Chick's a Goddess.
Tell us a little bit about how it is different. I mean, this book is a collection of essays that you've written over numerous years that cover a wide range of topics, most of which take place in your 40s. Talk a little bit about how the process of writing these and these observations is different from what goes into your plays, Wendy.
Oh, it's very different because the persona you create is yourself. And some of these things are not, well, both, you know, you wouldn't write a whole play about Vogue magazine sending a personal trainer to live with you. I mean, because it would be a tragedy. But also, there are certain things that were very personal in these essays. I mean, they range from comedic pieces like Chick's a Goddess, which is about, really was a response to Madeleine Albright realizing she was Jewish and Tom Stoppard realizing he was Jewish and there being a headline on the New York Post that said, Oy vey, Hillary's Jewish. So I wrote an ironic essay of, you know, in which I come out as an Episcopalian. So, but towards the end, there's an essay about my sister's battle with breast cancer and then the birth of my own daughter, which I wouldn't write as a play, but as a personal essay. But I felt the need to write about.
There is also this aspect which you touch on at the very beginning of the book, that in writing about your 40s and in looking at the whole panoply of these essays, that it was sort of your to-do list for the 40s.
Yes, I always, in fact, when I turned 30, I had this to-do list of fall in love, have a baby, move, and then it landed up on my 40s to-do list, too. So, you know, I sort of postponed sort of growing up for, you know, the longest possible time. I lived in a hotel for a long time, a sort of transient creature. So I think that when I looked at the 40s, it was really, in my case, coming of age.
And certainly for many baby boomers, I think, the same is very much the case, that there is this ongoing to-do list, which mostly has to do with being responsible and growing up and taking on all of those things. What is it about some baby boomers that never seem to accomplish those things and others for which it comes naturally?
You know, I don't know. I think it's that both the idea that there is an infinite future, so that there is a to-do list. Because I think when you come up of not only coming of age, but you come up against age, both in terms of aging parents and one's own health, you know, that whole idea of there's always a to-do list, there's always a gym, there's always something else interesting to do. I think also from coming of age in the 60s, you have that idea of finding yourself, and that's ingrained in us. So you sort of, oh, I've, you know, found I'm really, you know, looking for something now.
But somehow in so many of your stories, as you write, food and dieting are always somehow a part of it, no matter what stage it's at.
That's right. No matter where you are, there it is about, you know, looking good or, you know, I know my life will change if I lose 20 pounds, which is crazy.
Also, the whole value of family, which is certainly permeates many of these stories in so many different ways, and is an issue that is, I think, about which many baby boomers are very conflicted during the course of their lives.
Yes, I think so. I mean, for me personally, I was the youngest of four children, so it was very much about family, and I'm a classic baby sister, completely. I mean, I don't want to be in charge of anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, you know, an ingratiating character. But I think one thinks also, coming of age in the 50s, there was that whole idea of, oh, nuclear family and father knows best, and that all exploded. So I think for us it was, well, how do you create a family? In the Heidi Chronicles, someone says, in our lives, our friends are our family. And then you come from a generation from the feminist movement, the gay movement, and new kinds of families.
Talk a little bit about your decision to create your own nuclear family at 48.
Yes, I had a baby, little Lucy Jane, at 48, and it was really a decision. I wanted to have a child, and it was something I decided, I think it's something I always knew, and I postponed because I was, you know, busy, and also I was someone who didn't think about juggling. I mean, I really wanted to put on my plays more than anything else. Could only see myself putting those plays on if that was the focus of my life. And I don't regret that at all. But I think underneath there was a yearning for a family or a child. And, you know, I found myself in my 40s without a mate and with this desire to have a child.
Talk a little about that desire and whether it is this biological clock that is so much a part of sort of the vernacular of the culture and of baby boomer culture, or is there something else on an intellectual level that is driving that desire?
I don't think in my case it was a biological clock because, you know, I think I'm someone who, you know, has sort of made their own life and, you know, may well
right.
have been on a junior year abroad for like 20 years. I'm not sure. So, you know, in sophomore slump for like 5. So I don't think it was that. I think it was to have, and I also, because I've lived alone for so long and, you know, been someone who has been very fortunate to have a career that meant a great deal to me, I truly don't believe, you know, oh, children are the answer to life or marriage is the answer to life or whatever. I don't. I think one has a totally fruitful life alone as well. And but I guess that desire was for me to deepen my life, to somehow connect myself to my own family and also to give to someone. I mean, I've taught a lot. I've started a program in the New York City public school system of bringing kids to plays. I really wanted to be involved with the future somehow and with a child.
And has having a child changed your view of the world in any significant ways?
Having a child, actually, yes, it has, because I do think about the future much more than I used to. Or I walk down the street and, you know, look at all these people walking down the street talking on telephones, and then I about, you know, what they ate yesterday or something, and I think about my daughter's world and what's the world going to be like. And it makes me think about the culture of this country a lot and trying to somehow preserve that culture, nurture the culture, what feeds the soul, all of those things.
What are the things you worry about most in terms of the culture and the world that your daughter will inherit?
I think about that the things that the respect for those who are the audience of the culture will diminish in some ways. And I worry that what we call, quote, high culture, music, dance, theater, whatever, will be put aside as sort of elitist or whatever. And I think that's not true. And also I think that does feed the soul genuinely, because I think it's, you know, the work of an artist.
How does that battle get fought? How do you fight the battle that those things that are part of, as you said, high culture, are not in fact elitist, and that they really have a great value, and that the more they are part of everyone's life, the better the society as a whole will be?
I think you begin with, you know, arts in the schools. I say arts education, getting kids to, you know, plays, getting them to dance, making sure that that's available to them.
One of the other things that you certainly spend time talking about is your mother and your relationship
yes.
with your mother.
Lola.
Tell us a little about Lola.
My mother's name is Lola, and she's a dancer, like the Barry Manilow song. It's true. And she's a really interesting person because she still dances. And as my mother says, she's, you know, 21 plus, and now she's 31 plus. And she, you know, she's like someone. I audition actors, and they come in and say, I dance with your mother, she's a hoot. She wears leather pants and has a jacket that says Lola on it. And she, although at the opening night of the Sisters Rosenzweig, my play on Broadway, the literary manager of Lincoln Center came up to her and said, "You must be so proud of Wendy." And my mother said, "Yes, but wouldn't it be nicer if this was Wendy's wedding?"
And how does she feel about the things that you write about her?
Oh, she'll always say, "That's not me. It's not me." But it is. But it is. I mean, my mother, I think, is one of the most interesting characters I've ever known.
Why is that?
I think because, well, because she's such an independent thinker, and it's such a convolution of old world. My mother's an immigrant, and also her own sort of independence in a way. So she's her own, she truly is her own creation.
And how does she view your daughter? What is their relationship like?
You know, she loves my daughter. I stump the stars. My mother truly never thought I'd have a child. I mean, truly. So the fact that I had Lucy Jane and she is this beautiful, lovely child, I think is a joy in my mother's life.
On the dark side of all of this, you write very movingly about your sister's battle with breast cancer. Tell us a little bit about that essay in the book.
Well, that's the essay that was never published before, that I wrote for this book. That was something that I didn't think of it on a magazine stand somehow. My sister Sandra was a pioneer in corporate America. She was, when I think of high school, it was trips to General Foods to see my sister, who was the first female vice president of marketing at General Foods, and there would be Sandy and all these men in suits. And the men in suits turned out to be eventually Lou Gerstner, who became the chairman of IBM, and this Rick Braddock, who's the chairman of Priceline. And Sandy, if she were a man, would have become a CEO of a major American company. She was head of the card division of American Express. She was very much, you know, the figure in my life who made me think, well, a woman can do these. There is a trail that you can, you know, go out and do these things. And Sandy had breast cancer in her 40s and then a recurrence in her 50s. And she was amazing. I mean, for like 8 years or something, she went to work. I mean, she would go to work valiantly. And, you know, despite her many, many different therapies that she was on, and, you know, eventually, you know, there wasn't another therapy, basically. But I wrote about it because my search for fertility and Sandra's battle for breast cancer sort of paralleled each other. And in some ways, we both came up against a wall, although, I mean, hers was tragic, I think. And certainly in terms of me and how I spent my 40s, that completely changed my life.
And you've written about her elliptically, perhaps, in Sisters Rosenzweig and,
yes,
and other places as well.
Yes, she is the lead character in Sisters Rosenzweig, which was funny. I must have had a prescient feeling, but she's the banker, Sarah, that who moves to London and that the furrier walks into the house and falls in love with. Yeah.
We were talking about culture before. There's a couple of celebrity interviews that are part of the essays in Chicks a Goddess. And also you talk about your journey to the Golden Globe Awards,
yes,
in Hollywood. Your feelings about this celebrity culture that we seem to be bathed in?
I feel very mixed about it. I mean, I think, you know, actors are wonderful people. In some ways one is in awe of them. But one also thinks, I remember when I was in the hospital with Lucy Jane and I was there for 4 weeks and had preeclampsia, there was this nurse who would come in every night and take care of me. And I thought, it's insane what this nurse is being paid and what, you know, Bruce Willis is being paid. Because it seems to me what this nurse is doing is really hard and really humane. And, you know, you do think about, you know, just people and where why this is who is being celebrated in life and what's the contribution to the culture.
And beyond the contribution to the culture, there is also the business of talent and the degree
right.
to which we pay people sometimes in the celebrity culture, not necessarily for their talent, but just for the very virtue of being famous.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. Or why is Jennifer Lopez on the cover of everything now?
Right.
She's like everywhere. It's amazing. And you think, well, is this about her? Is this about the people who are marketing her? What is this about?
Well, it is about the fact that virtually everything in our culture becomes about marketing, about selling something.
Right. I think that's true. So it does, you know, and the content, who knows about the content? It's like all kids now know the weekend grosses for movies. I found that fascinating.
Right.
You know, there's something, when you're in L.A., it's very egalitarian because the people at Kraft Services or the president of, you know, Columbia or Sony, all know the same thing. They know what the weekend grosses were.
And that used to have a kind of elitist quality to it. I mean, now the information has become more democratized.
Oh, no, my little nephew knows it on the Internet.
Right.
Everyone knows it.
It's interesting, though, that the downside of that comes back to something I think that we talked about before, is that the degree to which everything becomes democratized also means that many things, cultural things in many cases, are constantly seeking their least common denominator, and it creates this attitude about high culture as elitist sometimes, as we talked about before.
Yes, I think that's right. And who makes that up is people who are, you know, development people or whoever they are, who are making these, you know, statements based on market research, and it has nothing to do. That's the thing. You have to get back to the basic things of, you know, a person reads a book and they're moved by it. A person sees a play by a person, or you see dance by people who have disciplined themselves to do a dance or, an artist, and you're moved by it. And that's a human communication.
Certainly is. What are some of the next plays in the offing, Wendy?
I'm doing a stage version of the old Gene Kelly movie, An American in Paris, which is great fun. I love doing that. And, I've, you know, spent the summer listening to Gershwin songs.
It's not a bad way to spend the summer.
No, Gershwin's lyric is nice work if you can get it.
Wendy Wasserstein, her collection of essays, Schick's a Goddess, or How I Spent My 40s, it's just published by Knopf. Wendy, I thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. We'll come right back.